Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 11th of October, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another glorious week in Blighty, and we are here today to discuss the last week's news and also to get into our Greatest Britons. And of course, we have with us today my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? It's a glorious autumnal day where I am. What's it like where you are?
Exactly the same. It's one of those days that makes you feel good to be alive.
It certainly does. The sun is streaming in, and here we are doing our duty to our listeners to produce uplifting, inspiring and educating content. And today we've got a little bit of all of that, I think, with what we're going to be talking about today. The first subject, which will probably be a theme through the first half of the show anyway, is this new TV series, Wrigley Road, which is based around the National Socialist Movement, Colin Jordan's National Socialist Movement from the 60s, which really, it got a lot of press space, it got a lot of headlines, but it didn't really have that many people that were really supportive of it. And the story that's being told is the story of this 62 group, which was a gang of Jewish Antifa thugs, basically, and it's about their infiltration of the NSM movement. It's about the fights that they had with the NSM movement. It's not actually a true story. The characters aren't real characters, but it is actually based on real events. And they've taken their view of the real events from Searchlight. They've taken it all from a left-wing magazine at the time. And there is actually a book that tells it all from the view of Colin Jordan. There's a very good book, in fact. It's called 'Twas a Good Fight, The Life of Colin Jordan. It's written by Steve Frost, who is now the General Secretary, I think that's what he calls himself, of the British Movement, which is still going, which is the organisation which Colin Jordan founded. And basically, the TV program is as you would predict it. It is making the National Socialists out to be terrible people, and it's making the Jews out to be wonderful people and great heroes. And in actual fact, this 62 group and the 43 gang that came before them, they were really violent thugs. If listeners want to look on the British history section of the site, they will see that we interviewed a 93-year-old man called Mr. I, and he lived through this time. He lived through the war, basically, and just after the war, he got involved in nationalism, and he talks about this 43 gang and the horrible acts that they were involved in, beating people up. They were thugs, basically, and this 62 group. And both of those groups now have been lionized and made out to be heroes, but they were basically criminals. They were physically assaulting people and putting them in hospital. So this program makes this violent group out to be the heroes, and it makes the nationalists out to be the bad guys, which is, of course, is what we're used to now. I did watch this the first episode of this just before we started, and I'll leave it to you to really explain what happened in the episode, Max, but I'll just say one thing I picked out at the beginning. They tried to show this sort of dichotomy between the Jews that were praying and they were blessing their meals, and then they were contrasting that with the evil Colin Jordan, who was teaching a three-year-old to do the Roman salute, and there was all this wicked evil music because somebody was raising their arm in the air. Very, very sinister, and I'm sure a lot of people would have been watching that and just sort of laughing at the ludicrousness of it. But yeah, I'll pass it over to you here, Max. What did you make of it, and is there anything else that you want to add to my little introduction to it here?
Well, what I'd say is that there seems to be a very big push on the part of Jewish organisations in order to create a feeling in the minds of the public that there is rampant anti-Semitism cursing through the British public, and that there is a need for people to be ultra vigilant and to take action in order to prevent the Third Reich from being reborn in Britain, which obviously is quite a sort of it conjures up quite a bizarre sort of image in one's mind. And this comes from the campaign that there was against Jeremy Corbyn, a man who was an anti-Zionist, but certainly not anti-Jewish. But he was portrayed by Jewish organizations as being anti-Jewish, just simply because he was anti-Zionist. And we've seen in recent days a double-page spread article written about Patriotic Alternative, trying to portray Patriotic Alternative as something which is sinister and something which people need to get very wound up about and that they need to take action against. So I'm expecting Ridley Road. I've only seen the first episode of it so far, but I'm expecting Ridley Road to be effectively, it is docudrama. It is more drama than it is documentary. But it is docudrama, which is being used, in my view, as propaganda to this same end. And it's interesting that There has been some criticism of the drama already from Jewish sources, where people are claiming that too many of the characters portrayed in the too many of the Jewish characters portrayed in the Ridley Road series are not actually Jews, and which I find quite strange, because on the one hand we have this. We have the fact, and this fact is stated in some of the sources that I've seen, where it's stated by Jewish people that the Jews are not a race, and I think that is a fairly accurate assessment. Jews aren't a race; there isn't a Jewish race, and it's pointing out that there are Jews of with many racial origins, and so therefore anybody of virtually any race was one of the statements that I have here. I'll just see if I can find the actual quotation for you, and this is from an article which is in iNews, which is an internet news website, and the article is written by a lady called Marianne Levy, who presumably based upon that name has some sort of Jewish extraction. And she says, I may be wrong there, and if I am wrong, then I apologise if that's if she finds that offensive. Where she says that it's not that that non-Jewish people can't play Jewish people well, but in the case of Ridley Road, identity is key to the story. Vivian and Jack were Jewish people who were forced by anti-Semitism to pretend to be otherwise. To have cast the parts with actors who are not Jewish feels uncomfortable and odd. Tom Vary, who plays Jack Morris, said in an interview with iNews, I think it's very it's a very important conversation. I don't know how important my opinion is on it, but it's definitely a conversation worth having. Agnes O'Casey, who has a Jewish grandfather, has said, I learned so much in this role, which was part of why it was so painful to realise that my casting might cause harm. But it's interesting that if you then sort of contrast that with an article that's in the Jewish on the Jewish Chronicle website about it, where it says that the practice of hiring non-Jewish actors to play Jewish characters has previously sparked debate, and it mentions about how David Baddiel has criticised this tendency. But it then says, last year, Maureen Lipman and Miriam Margolis joined a group of artists in signing a letter condemning a musical for the practice, which they said was akin to Jew face, i.e. the sort of equivalent of a white person playing a black person, except that it's a non-Jew playing the part of a Jew. One can be racially Jewish without being religious, and there are Jews of every skin colour. In practice, this means that non-Jewish people can and often do play Jewish people and vice versa. So on the one hand, we've got a Jewish source stating that Jews can be of any race or colour. And then on the other hand, we've got Jewish people criticising this programme for allowing non-Jewish people to play Jewish parts.
It's a little bit contradictory, isn't it, really? But I would just say in their favour, though, I mean, the whole point is that they've got these infiltrators that are infiltrating into the Aryan supergroup of the National Socialist Movement, and it would have been a little bit difficult if they looked extremely Jewish, wouldn't it? If, you know, if they had side locks and they had the distinctive Jewish nose, then they wouldn't have been able to infiltrate this movement, so that they had to look as if they were non-Jewish. So, I mean, that would be the argument that I would make there. But yeah, please continue.
Yes, I think that there's a fair amount of caricature that we can expect to see in this program. For example, there's a scene where Colin Jordan is teaching a three-year-old to do a straight-armed Nazi salute, and that's contrasted with Jewish people who, or scenes of Jewish people having a meal where they're observing Jewish ritual, etc., and are being portrayed as being entirely peaceable people. But the period in which the period that this program is describing is one in which the 62 group is formed, and people who've investigated back into these trends in the past may be aware of the fact that there was a precursor to the 62 group, which was the 43 group. And the 43 group was a group of Jewish ex-servicemen who decided that they were going to make absolutely sure that nothing like National Socialism would ever be able to become established in British society. And so using the skills that they had learned in the British Army fighting during the Second World War, they attacked meetings that were being organized by people who were sympathetic to Sir Oswald Mosley at the end of the Second World War. So there was some vicious fighting that took place then. But then as Mosley's organization declined, so the violence fell away. But then as Colin Jordan started to form his National Socialist Movement in the 60s, the 62 group, or effectively the 43 group, was revived with some younger members as the 62 group, and they then set about attacking the meetings that Colin Jordan organised just as viciously as the 43 group had attacked the meetings organised by Sir Oswald Mosley. And so it isn't a matter that there are nasty, evil fascists on one side and that there are lovely, peaceable Jews on the other side. What there was, as far as this episode in time was concerned, is a struggle between two groups, one group being very committed Jewish nationalists who formed a violent group to attack the fascists and the National Socialists. And on the other hand, there would have been people within the National Socialist Movement that decided that they had to defend themselves against these attacks. And so there would have been violence being committed by both sides against the other side. And so it isn't a one-sided story. It's a story of where both sides need to be appreciated if one is to have a rounded view of of that period of history.
Well, one of the things I think they did get accurate was the fact that they had the Trafalgar Square rally and they were being pelted by tomatoes, but I think they were being pelted with rocks and bottles and all sorts from the crowd. But then after that, they were saying that the police never go after the Nazis, and that's completely false, because Colin Jordan's bookshop, there were quite a few arson attempts. There was a lorry that drove through it. There were bombs that were thrown into it. And nobody was ever investigated or arrested for that. So that's a falsehood to say that nobody ever went after the Nazis and they just went after the anti-fascists, because there were all these attacks that took place against Colin Jordan. They will also be mentioning the synagogue arson attacks, and of course this is something that we completely condemn, any violence or any property damage whatsoever supposedly in the name of nationalism is harmful to our cause. It doesn't do us any help whatsoever. It just does us harm, and on top of that you've also got the harm that it does to the other group. But what happened during the 60s, there were a series of arson attacks, and this was portrayed as if this was Colin Jordan's doing, and yet there was never any evidence found to show that it was Colin Jordan's doing. In fact, some of the arson attacks were actually carried out by somebody called Aubrey Cadogan, and it is possible that he was actually Jewish. The group that the four lads that they did get for doing the arson attacks, they got arrested and they got jailed, and they were to do with Colin Jordan's wife, who he was split up from. She actually did time for encouraging these arson attacks, and these four lads, I think it was that got sent to prison. They then got released from prison on the orders of a judge, and they all turned up in court denouncing Colin Jordan and what a wicked, evil man he was for inspiring them, and all turning their back on National Socialism. And it turned out that they had all been paid by this 62 group to do this. So there was this scandal, basically. I mean, have you ever heard of that? A load of people just being released from prison halfway through their sentence because they then going to condemn somebody else. And I've got a quote here from the book that actually deals with what happened there. Despite the declarations by the police and the director of public prosecutions that Colin Jordan himself was not a suspect in these cases, the accusations persisted. Such was Colin Jordan's anger at this continuing insinuation that he went to court in 1976 in pursuit of a libel action against the Jewish editor of Searchlight magazine, A. Morris Ludmer. And at the time of his death in 2009, Colin Jordan was in the process of preparing a court action against the later editor of Searchlight, Jerry Gable. Many years later, in a search for the truth, the libertarian writer and researcher Alexander Baron entered into a period of correspondence with Colin Jordan about the synagogue arson case, and at the same time scoured the public records, court archives, and newspaper archives. And the result was a booklet entitled A Revisionist History of the 1960s Synagogue Arsons. Although much of the publication is dedicated to attacking the characters of 62 group leader Harry Bidney and Searchlight's editor Jerry Gable, and the unreliability of Searchlight's statements on the synagogue arson cases, Mr. Baron does present a string of supported evidence to undermine the accusations levelled against Colin Jordan since 1965, including correspondence with the former investigating police officer Albert Burke Wickstead, who retired from the Metropolitan Police with the rank of commander. At the end of his research, Mr. Baron concluded, although there is no documentation available, it is almost certain that Jukes was offered some financial inducement to perjure himself in order to implicate the innocent Colin Jordan. Why else would he have done so? And that was this one character that also perjured himself, basically, as he said there, and said that Colin Jordan was involved in this. And this was all taken from A Revisionist History of the 1960s Synagogue Arsons, 3rd edition, 2002. So it looks like what they're going to be doing in this series, they're going to be showing these synagogue arsons, and they're going to be pretending that this was official National Socialist Movement policy was to set fire to synagogues, which of course it wasn't. Colin Jordan's wife, Francois Dior, she was always a bit of a loose cannon, basically, and they had actually split up when this occurred. And I think Colin Jordan himself actually gave a denunciation of the synagogue activities. Where have I got this here? Colin Jordan rushed out an internal NSM bulletin stating, "We wish to make it clear to everyone the National Socialist Movement, in the sense of its leadership by Colin Jordan, has never instigated or encouraged in any way whatsoever been associated with acts of arson against synagogues or Jewish property. The leader of the NSM rejects and condemns such acts of pure destruction as being most of all damaging to our movement and its cause. And the NSM leader condemned the arson attacks in the strongest possible terms, making it clear that the use of force and violence was counterproductive and that it gave the state an excuse to crack down on the NSM and at the same time generated public sympathy for the Jewish victims. For the NSM, neither situation was desirable. Colin Joyner would later point out that arson attacks on Jewish targets by the NSM were robustly investigated by the police, in contrast to the fleeting investigations of arson attacks on the NSM offices at Princedale Road. As he saw it, it was one rule for them and one rule for us. Colin was also adamant that the activities of the agent provocateur, P.W. Dukes, and the role of the 62 Group boss, Harry Bidney, in the affair were never fully investigated, and the actions of Bidney and friends were glossed over and presented to the court as something very different to the reality. And what we're going to see on this television programme is going to be basically Bidney's view of this. So we have to put this out there so that people get a balanced view of it, obviously. And I say, if people want to know the nationalist side of all this history, then get this book. It's a very good book. It's called 'Twas a Good Fight, The Life of Colin Joyner, by Stephen L. Frost. What do you know about these synagogue attacks, Max? I know you didn't get into nationalism until about 10 years after this. Was there still talk about this at the time, do you know?
No. From the point where I got involved with nationalism, there has always been a policy of never engaging in violence of any kind, unless, of course, you're attacked, in which case you're entitled to defend yourself. If you read the autobiography of Oswald Mosley, he mentions in there that his black shirts were formed in response to attacks upon his meetings by violent Jewish groups, and obviously I'm not suggesting that every Jew would have been involved in this sort of thing, but there were violent Jewish groups who were violently opposed to the existence of Oswald Mosley's movement, and they attacked his meetings, and he talks about his meetings being attacked by people that were armed with knuckle dusters and bicycle chains and knives, so the his black shirt organization was formed in order to protect his meetings from those kind of attacks. That would have been prior to the Second World War, but also at the end of the Second World War, where his meetings would have been under attack from the 43 group. But as Oswald Mosley aged and his movement tended to dwindle, the violence also subsided. But then with Colin Joyner and John Tyndall forming the National Socialist Movement, as they did in the 60s, then the 62 group was formed, which was a revival of the 43 group. And again, the same kind of violent tactics were employed in attacking the meetings of Colin Joyner and John Tyndall. And my experience of nationalism is that there has always been a tendency for our meetings to be attacked by violent opposition, not always Jewish organizations. Some of them, particularly in the 70s and the 80s, they tended to be extreme left-wing organizations. And so there has always been need on the part of nationalist organizations to be prepared to defend yourself if you hold any kind of a meeting, particularly if you hold a public meeting. And the despite the content of these sort of docudramas such as Ridley Road, and despite what might be said in the double page spread that's appeared in the Times in the last few days, there isn't any intention on the part of nationalist organizations to use violence in order to take control of this country. Where nationalist organizations like Mark Collett's Patriotic Alternative, where they do indulge in any kind of fitness training or in any kind of self-defense training, it is exactly that, self-defense, because if nationalist organizations were held and conducted and they didn't have people who were able to physically defend the meetings, then those meetings would be attacked and the people that attended those meetings would be severely injured. And I can recall a meeting that I went to, which was organized in Bristol several years ago now. It probably would have been, if I think back to it now, it would have been 5 years ago now, and it was a meeting which was a perfectly peaceful meeting. It had been organized as a private meeting, and yet, and you were present as well, Sven, it was a meeting where a group of Antifa had slowly approached the meeting. They had attacked somebody who's stood outside having a cigarette, and they had then lobbed half bricks through the windows, smashing all the windows down one side of the building, and then started to attack the meeting. And it was a meeting at which we had to very robustly defend ourselves. Otherwise, we would have been quite bad, severely beaten. And the people that attacked that meeting were also carrying sticks and iron bars and bicycle chains. And so we had to defend ourselves very, very vigorously. And that's a sad thing, but it's an absolute travesty that the opposite is portrayed in the media by the Times and their double-page spread article with all of its innuendos that Mark Collett's organising a kind of sinister organisation when nothing could be further from the truth, and the docudramas like Ridley Road, where they try to create the impression that there is some threat of extreme violence from people of a nationalist persuasion, when in reality that's not the case at all.
I do have to point out that Patriotic Alternative doesn't actually have any self-defence classes or self-defence training. That they do fitness and health training, because we believe in a healthy body and a healthy mind. But it is interesting that they're sort of putting these two things on at the same time. The Times double spread, and there's also this program that's on at the time. They will definitely be talking about Spearhead in this program, which was this unit that Colin Jordan and John Tyndall were forming with the idea of self-defense, and they were wearing uniforms, and I think they're trying to tie that into the Keep Fit classes that Patriotic Alternative are doing. And there's also another parallel as well, because at this time, after the Trafalgar Square rally, Colin Jordan and I think one of the other speakers were prosecuted under the original 1930s Public Order Act. So they were actually prosecuted under it. But because of this rally, the pressure groups, the communist pressure groups and the Jewish advocacy groups, they were able to put pressure on the government and get them to bring a new Public Order Act in. And we had the 1965 Public Order Act, which restricted what people can say, even more so than the 1935 one did. And this coincides with today. We've also got pushes to change the free speech rights that we have. We had this, I think her name was Amira Khan earlier this year, with a Countering Hateful Extremism report, and she was saying that she wanted a new category put into law, hateful extremism, which is basically people's speech that doesn't come under terrorism law and doesn't come under the Public Order Act, but she doesn't like it anyway, so it should be banned. So the people that are lawfully sticking to the law and what they're saying, they're making certain that they're not actually breaking any laws. She says, well, we need to still go after them anyway, because we don't like them, because they're nasty people that want to stand up for their own people. Basically, they want to speak up for their own people, and they love their own people. So we should change the law so that we can silence them. So it's interesting that they're putting out this TV program at the same time as the Times article, and at the same time as these pushes to change the law. There was another bit that I wanted to talk about it as well. Colin Jordan himself was a teacher, and he did actually keep his teaching role for quite some time. And the teaching organisations, they said, well, he's doing this in his spare time. Unless there's any evidence that he's also doing it while he's at work, then we can't really get rid of him. And eventually, though, there was so much pressure put on them that he was actually sacked from his teaching role. And I just thought that was interesting to contrast that with today, when people will be using Twitter or Facebook in their spare time, not necessarily doing it at work, and yet they can lose their job for that, because they'll say, well, this is looking bad on the job, but it's in your spare time. It's not while you're at work that you're doing that. And that has now changed today. So if you hold unpopular opinions, whether you're doing that at work or not, it can get you into trouble with your employment. And that was the other thing. All the people that were involved with that Trafalgar rally, they all lost their jobs. It was all pressure put on them to lose their jobs. And again, that will be lionized in this TV program. But really, it's ruining a man's chances to provide for his family. You know, it's leaving them starving.
Yeah, there was a period immediately after the Second World War when, because so many men and women felt that they had just spent the last 5 years of their life fighting totalitarianism, that they would respect people's right to freedom of speech and freedom of conscience. And so during the early post-war years, and certainly during my childhood, there was a feeling that it was a free country, and people used to say that if somebody criticized anybody for anything they said, they used to say, it's a free country, you can say what you like, and the sticks and stones will break my bones but words will never hurt me, was a saying which was repeated many, many times during those days. But those things are not said any longer. People don't say sticks and stones may break my bones. People don't say it's a free country any longer, because there is a dawning in the minds of increasing numbers of our people nowadays that we no longer live in a free country, and that there are people who are insidiously working away, trying to create a totalitarian society where people aren't allowed to believe what they actually believe. People, or if they believe something which is regarded as politically incorrect, then they must never, ever express their misgivings about the politically correct position. They have to continually parrot the politically correct position. I can remember a few months back there was a degree of hilarity at some of the ceremonies and processions that were being held in North Korea, where the people that attended these ceremonies clapped a ridiculous amount of enthusiasm everything that was said by the North Korean leader, to such an extent that it was obvious that these people were terrified that they might be identified as somebody who didn't have the same love and adoration for their leader as they were required to have, and we're slowly moving in that same direction where people are afraid to actually express their real views, particularly if their real views are in any way critical of the current political establishment and the current politically correct positions.
You know, we used to be taught or encouraged to have tolerance for other people's point of views. And we were told, well, everybody might not have the same point of view as you, and you should have tolerance for people that have different points of view. And today you can't even get into university unless you answer all the questions correctly about how you need to be announcing your guilt before you actually go into the university, and announcing how guilty you are for being a white man and what a racist you are. And if you don't answer the questions correctly, you have to go back and do the test again, and basically uphold the cultural Marxist narrative before you can even get into the university. And that's going on in our top universities. Well, shall we go back to a brighter period in our history, Max, and talk about our greatest Britons, do you think?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, let's get into our greatest Briton for the week, which is Captain Robert Falcon Scott once again, and we'll begin with a recap. Last episode, we heard how Scott met Clements Markham once again and discovered that he was planning a trip to the Antarctic. Scott was keen to go on this trip because it would give him the freedom to really explore what he was capable of. The expedition was arranged by the Royal Society and the Royal Geographical Society, but private investors and capitalists had to pay for the trip, simply for their own prestige and for that of their country. The societies simply wanted their scientists to be dropped off by a navy and for them to be in charge, but Markham insisted that the navy should be in charge, and it was only by luck that Markham's people were able to outvote the scientists, and Scott was then confirmed as the expedition leader. And that's where we got to last week. Is there anything else that you wanted to add to that, Max?
No, that seems fine.
Okay. Well, in December 1900, Professor Gregory arrived in Great Britain from Australia to organise his side of the expedition. When he got to London, he was shocked to learn of his position on the team, since he had expected the Antarctic command to have been placed under his direction. He expected to lead the expedition on the ice while Scott wintered over in Melbourne. According to Markham, instead of going to work on his scientific program, Gregory set about conspiring with the hydrographers to have Scott's leadership role overturned. But try as he might, Gregory was unsuccessful in his bid to capture the command. In May 1901, Gregory was sent a telegram with a choice to either serve under Scott's command or to resign. Gregory resigned in disgust. Dr. George Murray, the head of the Botanical Department of the British Museum, was appointed in his place, on the condition that he go only as far as Melbourne to give scientific advice and training to the other scientists, and then to return to his duties at the museum. Gregory went on to occupy the chair of geology at Glasgow University for 25 years, and at the age of 68, while crossing a river in Peru, he drowned. So he was still lively in his elder years. Is there anything on that that you want to pick up on, Max?
Well, just that there was this this controversy about Scott's leadership, with the scientists wanting the scientists to lead the expedition, but with the contrary viewpoint, which was Clements Markham's viewpoint, that Scott, as the naval commander, should be the person who has ultimate responsibility for deciding the course of the expedition. And when one considers the dangerous conditions into which they were venturing, then that really was the most sensible point of view.
Oh, yeah. I should imagine this, the guy that ended up in, well, the original fellow probably never actually been to the Antarctic before, and probably had no idea of just what a trial of endurance it was actually going to turn out to be. Well, after his meeting with Markham in June 1899, Scott went back to sea and resumed his duties aboard the HMS Majestic. And on June the 9th, 1900, he received his letter of appointment, and 2 days later, he wrote a formal letter of acceptance to the committee. A follow-up letter arrived on the deck of the two presidents shortly thereafter, in which Scott had written, "Number one, I must have complete command of the ship and the landing parties. There cannot be two heads. Number two, I must be consulted on all matters affecting the equipment of the landing parties. Number three, the executive officers must not number less than four, exclusive of myself. Number four, I must be consulted in all future appointments, both civilians and others, especially the doctor. Number five, it must be understood that the doctors are first medical men, and secondly, members of the scientific staff, and not vice versa. Number six, I am ready to insist on these conditions to the point of resignation, if, in my opinion, their refusal imperils the success of the undertaking." I'll just stop there. I wonder what his point there is so insistent about. I can understand all of them, but the bit about the doctors have got to be first medical men, secondly members of the scientific staff, I guess because the health is most important. But I'm just trying to imagine any situation that might occur where they would actually have to make a choice between that, possibly because of the mission, and they wanted to continue the mission. The scientists wanted to continue the mission. But the medical men were saying, well, no, we can't on health reasons, possibly. What do you think of these 6 points that he brings up here, Max?
Well, I think in view of the fact that his authority has been challenged severely so far, I think it's reasonable that Scott would want to set out very clearly what he thought were his prerogatives. I think as far as the rule number five that he sets out, which is that it must be understood that the doctors are first medical men, it is pretty much as you said. I think that if they're going to be venturing into extreme conditions where the health of other members of the team are going to be is going to be placed in jeopardy, then what he needs is for the scientific staff to be watchful of each other's physical condition, and also watchful and careful of the physical condition of the naval people that are accompanying them. And if you're in a situation where somebody could go on to make a scientific discovery, leaving behind other members of the expedition team who have become ill as a result of their exposure to the extreme cold, etc., then as far as Scotty's concerned, then looking after the men that are part of the expedition comes before scientific discovery.
His men come before anything else, so he's a good leader. Scott went on leave for a few weeks and then started work by taking a course in magnetism at Deptford. Living with his two sisters and his mother over a shop in Chelsea, Scott started his day by jogging across Hyde Park for exercise before plunging himself into the planning for the expedition. Extraordinary details had to be worked out, and even Hugh Robert Mill, the distinguished librarian of the Royal Geographical Society, thought that Scott, if anyone, could bring order out of the chaos which had overtaken the plans and preparations. So it does sound like they're encountering some difficulty there. In October 1900, Scott and the Markhams went to Christiania in Oslo to consult Nansen. And I think Christiania is actually the Free State in... it's Oslo, Norway, isn't it? I'm thinking of Christiania in Denmark is the... Free State. He went to Norway, Christiania in Norway, to consult Nansen. His vessel, the Fram, had just returned intact with her crew after drifting right across the Arctic from the Siberian Sea to emerge after 35 months north of Spitsbergen, which proved the Arctic region to be an ocean rather than a continent. The Fram was designed like a saucer so that she would be lifted above the ice floes rather than crushed by them. It was a revolutionary design, but to reach the Antarctic, a ship would have to cross terrible seas and force her way through hundreds of miles of ice pack, so they thought a whaling vessel would be more suitable. Ironically, Amundsen later borrowed the Fram from Nansen and sailed her to Antarctica and right into the Ross Sea. Scott and Nansen quickly became fast friends. Of Nansen, Scott would write to his mother, "He is a great man, absolutely straightforward and wholly practical, so our business flies along apace. I wish to goodness it would go as well in England." Later, Nansen wrote of Scott, "I see him before me, his tight, wiry figure, his intelligent, handsome face, that earnest, fixed look, and those expressive lips, so seriously determined and yet ready to smile. The features of a kindly, generous character with a fine admixture of earnestness and humour." Nansen told him to get dogs, so he did as Nansen suggested and bought them in Russia. It was suggested that he buy Greenland dogs, which were bigger and better, but they were hard to get as the many Arctic expeditions of the previous 50 years had taken a toll on the supply of these dogs. 20 dogs and 3 bitches were selected in Archangel and sent to the London Zoo, where they were kept until they could be shipped to New Zealand. So no snowmobiles here. They're going to be using dog sleds to make their way across. I'm quite interested in this this shape of this vessel, shaped like a saucer. I mean, you wouldn't have thought that that would have been able to make its way through the sea without having bows there, but apparently it was okay. Got any comments on this, Max?
I would have thought that it probably would have had a very deep keel, even though the actual cross-section of the ship would have been saucer-shaped. So it would have been a saucer with a deep keel projecting down into the water. The reason why I assume that probably would be the case is that if you have a very broad, flat-bottomed ship, then in difficult seas, in very turbulent seas, that ship will toss from one side to the other and will be very unstable, whereas a ship that's got a deep keel will tend to be more stable. And that was part of the principle by which the ships of Sir Francis Drake were able to defeat the Spanish Armada, because the Spanish ships were very large, broad-bottomed and flat-bottomed ships that were tossed around in the stormy seas around the British Isles to a far greater extent than the wooden wolves, as they were called, the British naval vessels, which were narrow with a very deep keel. And so I would think that probably would be the case with the Fram, that although the actual hull of the ship wouldn't go deep into the water, it would have a shallow hull but a very deep keel.
You know, I'm just thinking about these dogs here as well. I mean, you would have thought that they would have wanted to get used to the dogs, so that the dogs got used to their owner, so there was a relationship between the dogs and the owner. But no, they're actually putting them in the zoo. I wonder if they went to visit them or anything like that. I mean, I did think that dogs had to well know, had to get used to their owners to build up a relationship. Don't you think, Max, do you keep dogs? Do you think this is a bit strange, keeping them in the zoo until they could then be shipped to New Zealand and then just used by them as if they were machinery?
Well, I think that as far as huskies are concerned, they tend to be less tamed than most domestic dogs would be. So I think the experience that most people will have with a domestic dog will be entirely different to that of husky. I mean, there are some huskies that are bred for their calm personality, but I think as far as the huskies that would be used for Arctic and Antarctic expeditions, they would be dogs that would be far more hardy, and they would be therefore from a genetic point of view far more closely related to wolves than domestic dogs, and so they probably wouldn't have made good house pets, but they would have been extremely good at pulling a sled. And as long as you had a good relationship with the dog that would be regarded as the alpha male amongst the huskies, then that probably would be sufficient for you to control the other dogs that made up the rest of the pack.
Yeah, so they'd be working as a pack, wouldn't they, rather than be working as individuals. Well, let's have a look at the crew then that he selected. On May the 29th, 1900, Albert Armitage was appointed to serve as second-in-command and navigator. Armitage, aged 36, came from the Merchant Navy, where he had been an officer in the P&O fleet. His prior experience came from his participation as navigator with the Jackson-Harmsworth Arctic Expedition of 1894. The expedition's primary goal was to determine if Franz Josef Land was part of a continent which might extend all the way to the North Pole. Armitage and seven others landed at Franz Josef Land and proceeded to spend 3 years in a hut within the 80 degrees north circle, shooting polar bears and doing scientific research. But Franz Josef Land was simply a series of scattered islands that had been incorrectly mapped by their discoverer, Julius Payer. One day, Armitage was searching the area with his field glasses when he spotted someone approaching on skis. The man was covered in oil and grease and black from head to foot. It was Nansen. Nansen and one companion had left the Fram and her crew to make a dash for the North Pole. Unfortunately, they too soon discovered the impossibility of such a trek. They wintered in a tiny hut, living on bear meat in a latitude of 86.13 degrees north, the furthest north record that stood until Peary reached the pole in 1909. Nansen and his companion had been dragging sledges and two kayaks, having eaten all the dogs by then, across 700 miles of ice, hoping to reach Spitsbergen, where whaling vessels occasionally called. Finding Armitage had saved their lives, as a trip across the open seas to Spitsbergen in kayaks would have resulted in certain death. They returned to civilization in July 1896 in the Windward. I mean, that is a stroke of luck, isn't it, that they just happened to come across this hut here. I imagine what they would have done otherwise. They would have just tried it in the kayaks, wouldn't they, I guess?
Yeah, that's right. And with almost certainly disastrous results.
And you can also think, I mean, at this time, that they're relying on these maps that have been drawn, but they haven't properly got a proper idea of where it is that they're actually going to, because it hasn't been properly mapped. I mean, even at this time, in 1894, they're discovering that what they thought was part of solid land is actually just a series of scattered islands. I guess they'd just been connected together by ice when they originally got there. And also, they didn't have the sou'westers that we have now either. So in order to keep themselves or protect themselves from the cold, it was whale grease and seal grease and seal oil that they would cover themselves in. So when you see the pictures of them, they're literally black from head to foot. And that's all this oil and grease that they put on. And they got that idea from the Inuit, from the Eskimos. You know, that's how they keep themselves warm. So yes. Difficult to keep yourself clean in those temperatures. Well, the doctor on the Jackson Harmsworth expedition to Franz Josef Land had been a Reginald Koetlitz, a 6-foot-tall man with a drooping moustache of German heritage. At the age of 39, Koetlitz received his appointment in 1900. Markham described him as a very honest, good fellow, but exceedingly short on common sense. However, Koetlitz was correct in his agreement with other notable doctors that scurvy, the plague of all polar expeditions, was caused by a poison resulting from putrefaction of preserved food, and the remedy for it was absolutely pure food. So again, they didn't even properly understand about nutrition at this time, but he was correct about that. It's interesting that Markham sees he's a very honest and a good fellow, but he's a little bit short of common sense. He's been very truthful here, and the drooping moustache of a man of German heritage, and when we still had these these little differences between our European ethnicities. The assistant surgeon was a young man recently qualified at St. George's Hospital. He had a wonderful talent for drawing and painting in watercolours. He was a deeply religious man, and he had a passion for birds. His name was Edward Adrian Wilson, the son of a Cheltenham doctor. A courageous young man, Wilson spent too many chilly nights birdwatching, too many long nights with his studies to make up for time spent in art galleries, too much starving himself so he could give money to beggars or to buy books, and probably too much smoking. He ruined his health and contracted pulmonary tuberculosis. After spending 2 years in Norway and a Swiss sanitarium, he shook the disease, but as soon as he began his duties as junior house surgeon, he contracted blood poisoning, which resulted in a painful abscess in his armpit. When Scott met him in 1900, his arm was still in a sling. Scott appointed him on the spot, but he still had to pass an Admiralty medical board. He failed the first time and the second exam only weeks before sailing, with a report saying Mr. E. A. Wilson unfit on account of disease in the right lung. Scott told Markham he must have him. And Wilson told Scott, I quite realise it will be kill or cure, and have made up my mind that it will be cure. Dr. Wilson's contributions to the expedition were enormous, and his incredible gallery of original artwork left for our enjoyment is highly prized and very valuable. And I mean, I was thinking at the beginning there, well, he's the assistant surgeon. You know, what is so important about him being able to draw and paint in watercolours? And I guess because it made up for photography, so he was able to paint the pictures. So it was actually very important what he was doing. And I guess we'll hear more about his contributions later on. Do you want to add anything to that about the assistant surgeon, Max?
Well, just that you know, he's the sort of person who, from the description you've given of him, there is somebody who is single-minded in everything that he does, and that's the kind of mentality that you need to have if you are going to achieve great things. It's one thing that I've noticed in all sorts of fields of endeavour, that for somebody to achieve at a very high level, they need to have this sort of single-mindedness of purpose, where they can ignore the less the more frivolous things in life that would otherwise distract someone.
Yeah, it's not all about qualifications, is it? It's also very much about character, and so it's interesting the way that they're describing the characters of the crew here as well. The three naval officers appointed at about the same time as Scott were Charles Royds as first lieutenant, Michael Barn as second naval lieutenant, and Reginald Skelton as chief engineer. Royds' charge was to deal with the men and the internal economy of the ship. He was serving on HMS Crescent, which was the flagship on the North American station at the time of his appointment. Michael Barn had been educated at Stubbington School in preparation for the Navy, and later served with Scott on HMS Majestic. Reginald Skelton also served with Scott on the HMS Majestic. A Norfolk man, he had joined the Navy as an engineer student in 1887 and served in various ships on various stations until Scott finally met him when he was appointed the senior engineer on the HMS Majestic. There were still three scientific positions to be filled, and the first of those, as naturalist, was offered to a Scot, W.S. Bruce. Unfortunately, he was busy organising his own Scottish expedition, the Scotia, in 1902, and he declined. The position was then offered to Thomas Vere Hodgson, aged 37, director of the Marine Biological Laboratories in Plymouth. And Markham writes about him, "A bit young to have a polished, bald head, sometimes needing a skull cap, but otherwise apparently strong and healthy." In actual fact, having a bald head is a sign of high testosterone, so it may have been something that you would be looking for in somebody young, because it would say that they're going to be particularly strong, maybe particularly bright. I mean, they have found a link with high testosterone and high intelligence now as well. But back then, I guess they thought a bald head, a little bit too young to have a bald head, that may be a sign that, I don't know, really. What do you think what do you think his worry was about being a bit young to have a bald head meant, Max? Any ideas?
No, I'm not really quite sure. I had a friend at school who was completely bald by the time he was 17. His hair just seemed to age sort of dramatically fast, and he always had a shiny bald head from that point onwards. I've known other people that have had completely bald heads, I've not really noticed that it is as a result of anything that would necessarily concern somebody who was planning an expedition.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we used to wear wigs to, you know, men used to wear wigs and wish to show that they had lots of hair, but in actual fact, it's the people whose hair falls out that actually have the most testosterone. The geologist Hartley Ferrar, aged 22, had just graduated from Cambridge with an honours degree. Born in Ireland and raised primarily in South Africa, Markham felt he was capable, but very young, very unfledged, and rather lazy. However, he most likely could be made into a man in this ship by the young lieutenants. The physicist was Louis Bonacci, aged 25. His appointment was so late in coming that he had to join the ship in New Zealand. He had spent a very adventurous childhood on a mountainous island that was uninhabited except for his family and their dependents. His father was a silk merchant from Lombardy and had bought the island from the Tasmanian government for £20,000. Louis studied physics and astronomy at the Melbourne Observatory and was the only member of the expedition to have prior experience in the Antarctic. He had spent 2 years with Borch Grevink's Southern Cross expedition and had wintered over in the hut at Cape Adare. Markham declared him always grown up, never a boy. And I should imagine he did mature well. I mean, living on your own on an island, I guess he's just got his family there. I guess there can't have been many distractions. What do you make of these descriptions here and the crew that he's got here, Max?
Well, living on an island, I think, it sounds strange, but it depends how many other people he had there, because it mentions that they were alone apart from their family and their dependents. And so it depends very much who the dependents were. It could well be that if the man was wealthy enough to buy an island for £20,000, which in those days would have been an immense amount of money, that he would have been fabulously rich, and that they probably would have had lots of servants. And so I would think that the family weren't quite as alone as one might imagine nowadays. I think, you know, if you were a young boy who, together with your siblings, had an island to explore, then that would be an absolutely wonderful thing for developing a sense of adventure. And so I imagine that he would have been that sort of a person.
They're collecting people from all over the white world as well, aren't they? You know, they're not limiting themselves to just people from Britain. They got people from all over. And I like the way he's telling us about their heritage as well as where they were born. You know, so it's nurture and nature. It's the environment people are brought up in as well as their ancestral heritage. I like the way this is all described. They would just be telling you where they were born now. They wouldn't be telling you what their ancestry was. Well, the next one, of course, is one of our former greatest Britons that we have already covered, Ernest Shackleton. Ernest Shackleton was an unusual choice. He was a merchant navy officer like Armitage, but no one had invited him to join. Shackleton went to sea at the age of 16 as an apprentice in a sailing vessel, and his captain considered him the most pig-headed, obstinate boy I ever came across. But he worked his way up the ladder and was soon the third officer in a Union Castle liner. He became engaged to be married and told his future father-in-law, "My fortune is all to make, but I intend to make it quickly." And unfortunately, he lost a lot of money, if I remember rightly. He was very ambitious, but he had no special interest in the polar regions or scientific research, for that matter. He applied to join the expedition and was promptly turned down. In Shackleton's case, it was a simple who-you-know matter. Llewellyn Longstaff, who had been the first to pledge financial backing to the expedition, had a son who was a passenger to Cape Town on the liner in which Shackleton served. The two men became friends, and Shackleton persuaded young Longstaff to set him up for an interview with Armitage. The second-in-command was impressed and recommended him to Scott, who in February 1901 appointed him third lieutenant in charge of holds, stores, provisions and deep seawater analysis. Armitage wrote, "His brother officers considered him a very good fellow, always quoting poetry and full of erratic ideas." Shackleton was forced to leave the expedition in 1903 and was replaced by George F. A. Mulock, who remained with the expedition until conclusion. Mulock was only 21, but had received excellent instruction as a surveyor in HMS Triton, and his services provided were invaluable. This concluded the complement of primary officers and scientists. The Navy also released 3 warrant officers and 6 petty officers, including Edgar Evans and David Allen from the HMS Majestic. Interesting to see the sort of character arc here from when Shackleton started off, and he was pig-headed and obstinate, and he makes his way through this excursion, this expedition to the Antarctic, and then of course he goes off on his own expedition, and possibly the greatest story of endurance ever told, which we discussed in our episode on Ernest Shackleton. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Max?
Well, again, it's people with single-mindedness of purpose and determination, which could also be interpreted as obstinacy, that is a common factor with a lot of these people.
And also, he kept morale high, didn't he? He was always reading poetry to them or quoting poetry to them, and he had erratic ideas. You know, you have to think about how the crew are going to get on with one another as well. They have to be people that are going to be able to be within an enclosed space just with this group of people for months, possibly years. So you have to be certain that they're not going to be the sort of people that are going to take offense at at little things. They're not going to be the sort of people that are going to start fights. They're going to need to be people that are extremely self-disciplined, and that are also friendly people that are not going to get depressed if things aren't going their way. You want people that are always going to be cheerful. And that was the great thing about Shackleton. He was always cheerful, and he made certain that the morale in his group on his expedition was kept high, even when he had to leave parts of the group behind and it seemed as if all was lost, that he still made certain that they kept morale high. Well, I think we should probably leave that here this week, Max, and we'll get into the building of the Discovery next week. So thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope that you have a great week ahead of you.